40 years ago today, President Lyndon Johnson signed the most far-reaching civil rights legislation the country had ever seen. The 1964 Civil Rights Act banned discrimination in employment. It empowered the federal government to withhold federal funding from programs and institutions that discriminated, and it banned segregation in public accommodations. No longer would black Americans encounter whites-only signs at water fountains, lunch counters, and on buses. The signing followed years of struggle for civil rights, a struggle that did not end with this legislation. Perhaps nowhere was that struggle felt more than in Birmingham, Alabama, the city Martin Luther King once called the most segregated city in America. Melanie Peoples went to Birmingham to talk with people about their memories of that time and how things have changed.
Think of pretty much anything you did today. Got up, took a bus or train to work, went out for lunch, maybe did a little shopping on your break. Or anything you might want to do tonight. Go out for dinner or a movie. Now imagine it's any year before 1964. You're black, and you live in Birmingham. There's a whole set of rules that defines your very existence.
Even at 14, I understood very clearly the delineations in Birmingham between white and black.
Sitting in Kelly Ingram Park, part of historic black Birmingham, Carolyn McKinstry motions towards imaginary borders, the downtown city streets that separated black from white.
We stayed pretty much in the confines of our community, at school, church. All of our trips were escorted or chaperoned so that we wouldn't wander off into areas where we weren't supposed to be.
Areas away from Smithfield or Fountain Heights and Central City. Neighborhoods where Birmingham's black citizens lived out their lives pretty much apart from whites.
When I was a young boy, there were several years that I didn't even realize that discrimination existed.
Segregation was so ingrained, for a time Reverend Calvin Woods had no idea he wasn't allowed or welcome in those other places.
We were just taught that we believed that white people had their place, black people had their place.
His family, like McKinstry's, did most of its shopping down on 4th, among the stores that lined Birmingham's black business district on 4th Avenue. But there were always some items that took them across imaginary borders to Bizitz and Loveman's, the city's white department stores. Only a couple blocks away, they might as well have been a continent away. The institutionalized segregation was a daily humiliation. It demeaned at every turn. Again, Carolyn McKinstry.
We were not permitted to try on the clothes when we shopped. We were not permitted to use the public restrooms. We were not permitted to eat at the restaurant. And, of course, no blacks worked in the store.
McKinstry didn't ask a lot of questions. That's just the way things were, part of being black in a Jim Crow town. Her parents, like many others, tried to shield their children from segregation's message.
I'm not sure that I ever heard the explanation growing up that we couldn't do something because this was the way whites had deemed it.
Mostly her mom concentrated on things the family could do, movies at the Carver Theater, or going to the zoo on designated black days. In between, when McKinstry and her brothers asked to go places segregation prohibited, her mom said they couldn't afford it. And mostly, they believed her.
Now, I do remember knowing there was a park here called Kittyland Park. It's over in the Inslee area. And that was every child's dream, to go to Kittyland's Park. There was the Ferris wheel and the merry-go-round and so forth. And I do remember knowing that we could not go there because blacks were not permitted to go there.
10 years older than McKinstry, Reverend Woods helped integrate the city's lunch counters and remembers the day the 1964 Civil Rights Act became law.
There was jubilation by many, and there was not jubilation by many others. You know, and of course, I think it was a great divine revelation to many of the white people because they saw they had been missing all that black money. You know, money, well, it's the same color as white money. So,
but it took a while for some. The public accommodations part of the act was the most controversial because it heralded the end of a legally sanctioned white-dominated social order. Ollie McClung was 24 years old in 1964.
In the social world, you can't go out and create new rights. So you want to give them to one group of people, whomever it may be, however laudable some people may think it is, you're actually taking from somebody else to do that.
And for McClung and his family, it was a loss of property rights that concerned them. He and his father ran Ollie's, a landmark barbecue restaurant in downtown Birmingham, where white customers ate in the dining room and black customers ordered takeout. Ollie's was one of the businesses that challenged the 1964 Civil Rights Act. McClung says they did it not because they didn't want to integrate, but primarily because they didn't feel the federal government should be allowed to tell local restaurants and businesses what to do. When the Supreme Court quickly upheld the law, saying the federal government did have the authority to govern small local restaurants, Ollie's opened its dining room to everyone.
It really didn't cause a terrible lot of problems. We had some customers that were upset. They didn't come back in, or didn't come back in for a while, but since it was pretty much everywhere was under the same law, it didn't have any disastrous effects on business. And also, people took it in a very good fashion.
But others didn't take it so well. In Atlanta, for example, Lester Maddox wielded a pistol and his customers raised pickaxe handles to keep blacks out of his restaurant, the Pickrick. Eventually, he closed its doors rather than serve black customers. Shortly thereafter, he was elected governor of Georgia.
The signs came down fairly quickly. The attitudes persisted.
Culpepper Clark is a dean at the University of Alabama and author of The Schoolhouse Door, Segregation's Last Stand at the University of Alabama. Clark says it took around 8 years for Southern whites to accept the fall of segregation.
I think the change has been remarkable. The ability of blacks and whites in the American South to commingle easily, to establish friendships, is probably the most basic freedom.
It has changed a lot.
Reverend Woods marks changes in Birmingham in that and more practical ways.
It has changed to the point where it's very evident that blacks are not overtly discriminated against. Blacks outnumber whites in key positions in the city, government, the Board of Education. Blacks are in the state legislature.
I feel fairly comfortable with going into any place that opens here.
Not that Carolyn McKinstry denies there are times blacks in Birmingham and other places encounter discrimination at hotels, restaurants, and even car rental counters. But it's a long way from not being able to go to Kittyland.
I think pretty much if you have the means, that's not a problem anymore. I think the last horizon for blacks is what we just said, the means, you know, the economic development portion of that.
To get the means, McKinstry is a firm believer in education and affirmative action. But she's quick to add that while legislators can pass as many laws as they want, neither Congress nor the Supreme Court can legislate goodness in people's hearts. For NPR News, I'm Melanie Peoples in Birmingham, Alabama.